We're all children of a special treat, a miracle of nature that we just call wheat. A crop that's in the Bible, a crop that's in our bread, a crop that's filled our bellies and held us in good stead. Through a history of starvation and times of want and woe, wheat has been our savior, our grub, our goulash dough. There's always lots of problems when we have enough to eat, but there's only one dilemma when there's not enough wheat. We feed you.
Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 20 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling Wheat Monetization, Little by Little. You might pay better attention to this podcast if I tell you from the beginning that depending on the actions of the Trump administration and Congress, the Northwest could be at risk of losing one of its top 10 wheat customers. Heck, so far this marketing year, which ends May 31st, only the Philippines, Japan, Korea, and Indonesia have taken more of the Northwest's flagship soft white wheat crop. What's the country? Let's call it Foodadia. You see, if soft white wheat purchased by the U.S. government and provided under the banner of food aid were a single country, it would rank among our most important destinations. Of course, Foodadia is not a single country. It's dozens of countries. And like Kool-Aid, food aid doesn't come in just one flavor. There's what's called in-kind aid, which is when the wheat we ship overseas is used to feed the hungry. War-torn Yemen has recently been a big in-kind importer of soft white wheat, taking 160,000 tons so far this marketing year. The other kind of food aid comes as part of a monetization program. I know, what the heck is monetization? I wondered for the longest time why bureaucrats just couldn't call it what it was, but I guess monetization saves a few syllables. Monetization is when the U.S. government buys wheat on the open market, then ships it to a specific country where it is sold to local mills, with the proceeds going to pay for NGO projects in the country. These projects may have nothing to do with feeding people directly, but they do expand the country's ability to feed itself. This marketing year, 86,000 metric tons of soft white wheat was sent to Bangladesh to be monetized. Stay with me. NGOs stand for non-governmental organizations, what we used to call charities. These outfits do good around the world, but they need funding to do it. By arranging to monetize wheat, the U.S. government essentially kills three birds with one stone. NGO projects are funded. Flour mills that might never have the opportunity to experience quality U.S. grain get that chance, and inventories of wheat here at home decline. For the record, all of our best soft white wheat customers, the Philippines, Korea, and Japan among them, started out taking U.S. food aid. With this primer under your belt, I can now move on to the real subject of the podcast, which is about a trip I took in March to Tanzania as part of a U.S. Wheat Associates study group to evaluate the effectiveness of monetizing wheat. Also on the trip were Mike Schulte, Executive Director of the Oklahoma Wheat Commission, Reed Christofferson, Executive Director of the South Dakota Wheat Commission, Leonard Schock, a Montana wheat farmer, and Ron Supas, a Kansas wheat farmer. Elizabeth Westendorf, policy specialist at U.S. Wheat Associates, led the trip. Tanzania is a long way from eastern Washington. Located on the east side of Africa, just south of Kenya, it is nearly 10,000 miles from Spokane. I can vouch for that. It took a couple of days just to get there. Although soft white wheat isn't being shipped to Tanzania, a lot of hard red winter wheat grown in the nation's midsection and some hard red spring wheat from the northern tier is going there. For the record, U.S. hard red winter wheat is the most donated wheat class this marketing year at 310,000 metric tons. Our first few days in Tanzania were spent in Dar es Salaam, a sprawling city on the Indian Ocean that includes a mixture of high-rises, BMW dealerships, malls, and expensive restaurants adjacent to tin-roof shanties, gridlocked streets, uncompleted buildings, and crude kiosks everywhere, with their entrepreneurs selling all variety of consumer goods. A country of about 52 million, Tanzania was originally a German colony. After World War I, it became an English colony. Following independence in the early 1960s, what was Tanganyika joined with the offshore island of Zanzibar to become Tanzania. In a town with the magical name of Morogoro, on the last day of our study group visit, I sat down with several members to talk about what was learned during our visit and whether monetizing wheat makes sense for farmers, the U.S. government, and the NGOs it funds. You might think donating wheat to feed hungry people or using its income to promote projects that help a country feed itself would be slam dunk popular, but such is not the case. Westendorf said U.S. food aid programs have come under criticism from the WTO and Congress, as well as a segment of the NGO community that promotes cash in lieu of commodities. She said the study trip has given the wheat industry the ammunition it needs to provide effective support for monetization programs.
This trip allows us to see what these programs look like on the ground, see how this wheat that is being shipped to Tanzania and monetized for USDA Food for Progress programs, how that does good and what these programs are doing and how it has an impact on the country. And with that knowledge, it makes it easier for the participants of this trip to go home and talk about why these programs still matter and why wheat still has a very vital role to play in them.
Give us some context. How has food aid changed over the last 50 years?
When the U.S. really started doing food aid, it was simple. It was shipping surplus commodities to countries that had a lack of food. I like to compare food aid of, say, the 1950s to food aid now as comparing a hammer to a scalpel. These programs have changed dramatically. We're talking about precision actions.
So is this all about getting rid of our surplus wheat?
No. And, you know, that's why we aren't just shipping the piles of extra wheat we have in Kansas right now overseas. This isn't about that at all. And in fact, we're not allowed to do that. We have commitments in the WTO that require us to be very careful about how and when we use in-kind commodities in food aid. It means that we can't disrupt a domestic market. We're not shipping surplus food anymore. It's more about shipping food that is needed, when it is needed, to the country that needs it.
Mike Schulte is executive director of the Oklahoma Wheat Commission and chairman of the U.S. Wheat Associates Food Aid Working Group. For years, the battle cry of that organization has been to keep the food in food aid. And while that is still an effective motto, it is not enough as more wheat is monetized. In fact, wheat is the most monetized commodity in the U.S. food aid arsenal. Schulte said it was clear when he took over the food aid working group that a new examination of the food aid landscape was needed.
There has been a lot of change in the international food aid programs in the last 10 to 15 years. And looking at these programs and the purpose they served since the 1950s, coming in and being asked to chair the food aid working group for U.S. Wheat Associates, I think it was real evident when I first stepped into the meetings that with the change that was taking place, that we as an industry also needed to embrace that change to be involved as we move forward to try to help people in their time of need and also utilize these programs for our producers back home. You can just look at the data and see that these programs being in place is allowing us to move wheat into countries that might not traditionally think about milling flour. It has an economic impact in these countries when the wheat is shipped to them. Typically, we are shipping this product into countries that are close to the equator, and we found that these regions are not typically the regions that are going to be effective or going to have the opportunity to grow wheat based on topography and climate. So we feel that this is not, by sending this product to these countries, it's not going to impact the market overall. However, we do know that it is creating economic development because when the wheat is shipped, then it's allowing industry to take place, millings taking place, money then is transferred between people's hands. It does help sustain a long-term economy, and in the end, then they become buying partners from us in the future. That's one of the goals.
Leonard Schock, a Montana wheat farmer and a former chairman of U.S. Wheat Associates, looks at food aid the U.S. provides as part of a bigger picture. He believes a well-fed world is a safer and more peaceful world, and what he saw in Tanzania gives him hope for the future. But the farmers there need a hand.
I am enheartened by what I saw as far as we have to feed the 9 billion people this world by 2050. These guys, with a little bit of short work in 10 years, could triple, quadruple their production. And no new land come in production. It's just start farming it correctly and giving them the incentives. We don't have to go breaking up or find new farmland. We just have to get better at what we have.
As Schulte explained earlier, tropical Tanzania and most of the countries where the U.S. donates wheat are never going to become wheat powerhouses. While there is a smattering of production at higher elevations, wheat is a cool season crop, so most of Tanzania's wheat is imported. And most of the country's farming is done at the end of a hoe. At one of the projects we visited, a single-row soybean seeder was brand new technology and expensive. It speeded up the time it took to seed an acre of soybeans from 7 days by hand to 1 day. Schock said the lack of progress he saw in Tanzania, which is in a region that genetic studies have indicated was the original Garden of Eden, opened his eyes.
Mankind learned how to walk here, you know, and what astounded me is man's been here this long, and now they're this far behind. That's a travesty. And I don't know how to fix it other than we help educate them with our monetized wheat dollars.
Supas, a Kansas farmer and also former chairman of U.S. Wheat Associates, recalled his thoughts at one stop as he walked the half mile to a farmer's fields.
What I was thinking of is, where was the U.S. 150 years ago? Were we about in that same position? And it's times like those that you stop and think about that. These people are maybe where we were at one time. We pulled ourselves up by the bootstraps. There isn't any reason, once we have our straps up a ways, that we can't pass some knowledge on.
Westendorf has a slightly different take on the subject, but one that also promotes peace as part of integrating Tanzania into the world economy, not to mention developing stronger trade ties with the U.S.
These programs are really a soft power initiative, and it is going to save us money on national security initiatives in the long run. And there's really proof for that. The Department of Defense really supports these programs for that reason. The other thing is that when we're developing, or when we're doing this agricultural development in a country like Tanzania, the goal is to get them to a level where they are a middle-income country, where they are strong trading partners in the world economy, and to get them to a level where maybe they eventually are buying a lot of U.S. products. That's not the primary purpose of these programs, but it is a benefit that we see in countries. You look at some of our biggest trading partners, Philippines and South Korea, and they both started out as countries that received food aid from the U.S. You know, those returns aren't something we saw within 5 years of sending that food aid, but over 50 years, those markets are really important to us, and maybe Tanzania is the next Philippines.
Supas said he had several discussions with farmers back home before he left for Africa. He made sure to let his neighbors know the funding the wheat sales were generating in Tanzania were not going to create competitors. NGO projects we observed included a bank that provides microloans to small farmers. Another was an effort to help small farmers diversify out of corn and into soybean production. Another was a feed mill expansion that helps pull more production from small farmers as it provides rations for a burgeoning poultry industry. And the money for all that, Supas said, ultimately comes from all Americans, not just farmers.
Farmers are not actually giving that money. The U.S. people are buying that wheat. The U.S. farmer is getting the same price he would have gotten for that wheat. But that translates over to those people that are being helped. They know the U.S. farmer is behind it, so it makes us look pretty good. The other point I think we should make out to the farmer is that monetization or food aid or what have you, that's a big exporter customer that we have. It ranks well within the 10 top 10 of our exporters, total supply. So the farmer should feel good about donating that stuff, or actually not donating it, selling it.
Do American farmers really care about anything other than finances?
I think they do. I think if you were to ask each individual farmer, probably 9 out of 10 of them do give to a charity of some kind. They care. They want to lend a helping hand, and this is a very good way to do it. The one thing that I noticed by visiting these different NGOs is that this may be the first time that they've had a face-to-face with a farmer and kind of made a connection there. And I think that's very important, because once they have that, they can pass that on to those people in those countries that they're helping learn how to farm.
What do you think, Leonard? Do farmers care about more than dollars and cents?
Oh, yeah. I mean, like Ron says, we give to our churches, we give to charities, we give and help our own people at home, and it's just of our nature. We're giving. We help our neighbors do things, and why shouldn't we? I mean, our world is becoming smaller, so this part of the world, in reality, is our neighbors. It takes a long time to get here, but they are farmers at heart out there, and they are trying to do very good things, and they want to do good things, and we just need to help them.
Is there anything that we can lobby for in the next farm bill which will benefit this sort of a program?
I think it definitely maintain the funds that are currently at work and definitely not have any shortfall or cutbacks. And again, as I think about this, I may see some areas that maybe some more dollars might help this. But I look at this, when you monetize wheat, like my class of wheat, hard red spring wheat, there's people that need the wheat, and there's too much wheat, so they just bought like a half a boatload of wheat, being 50,000 metric ton, and 24,000 was bought and is getting injected into Tanzania here. So we got rid of a half a boatload of spring wheat, and we got 50,000 farmers having funds available to them, and we have a flour mill that's learning how to mill very high quality wheat or blend his lower quality wheat up to standards, and he gets to have a lower input cost wheat, and then he gets to sell it to his customers just a little cheaper, and so it's a win-win-win.
Oklahoma's Schulte said one of his takeaways from traveling in Tanzania and meeting with various NGOs was the depth of need. It's something the U.S. wheat industry can't solve on its own, he said.
One of the things that I took away from the NGOs that we had the opportunity to meet with is that the need is great in all areas. And so I think not only maybe is it a matter of us just working with people in the wheat industry, but also reaching out to other people to work with these organizations to end hunger.
Supas, who visited multiple countries around the world during his stint as an officer on U.S. Wheat's board, said all people are generally alike in wanting to attain success. Ultimately, the aid the U.S. provides is a little like starter fertilizer, giving a boost not only to the individual farmers, but to the system as a whole.
I think most people, it doesn't matter what country you've gone to or visited, even our country, get a satisfaction out of achieving something, accomplishing something. These farmers that we saw, and some of them weren't farmers. Some of them were in another agribusiness occupation that this monetization was helping. What it was doing is helping the whole structure, the whole system there. But even those people, there's a pride in they've done something. Our world would be a far better place if everyone has something like that rather than sit down and ask someone else to take care of them and their hand out. And there's just, my opinion is it doesn't really matter what you do or what the program is. You need to have a little skin in the game so that you have some pride there.
The juxtaposition of modern amenities like our upscale hotels next to tin roof shanties or the air-conditioned bus our group traveled in to get to NGO projects where hoes were the primary implement surprised many in the group. But there were other, more positive surprises too, as Westendorf explains.
What surprised me in a good way, and part of that is what the NGOs are focusing on, is the number of women who were part of the conversations. We met with three separate groups of farmers, and in two of those three groups, women were the majority. And were more than willing to speak up in meetings. They weren't in the background. They weren't the secondary focus. They were the ones leading conversation and asking questions. And I don't think that's always the case. And so it's good to see that level of empowerment, because a lot of studies show that by building up the women in a rural population like this, it has exponential effects versus giving money or loans or assistance to the men. And so I think that it's good that these NGOs are realizing that and are doing that in their work.
Shock summed up what was learned during the Tanzania trip by recalling the poem of a young African girl that was part of a news story he saw back home. In the poem, a student talks about accomplishments coming little by little. Shock used the phrase to create his own poem about the experiences of the U.S. Wheat Associates trip to study wheat monetization.
I'm reminded on that walk to the field of a Malawi little African or East African gal, and she had a poem. The title of her poem is Little by Little. Little by little, we have educated ourselves. And this is not her poem, but summing up our week here. Little by little, we have educated ourselves. And little by little, maybe we have educated them. And little by little, we can raise everybody's lifestyles and standards of living. And little by little, the world will become better.
Although wheat disappearance is important to U.S. farmers, making the world a better place must certainly be a priority as well. Based on my experiences in Tanzania, I believe the wheat industry is doing its part to fulfill both goals. But we need the commitment of the U.S. government to continue this important work. Please do what you can to see that support to help the world's less fortunate continues. Help those in positions of power to understand that wheat monetization and in-kind food aid doesn't just benefit farmers, it benefits everyone we share the planet with. That's it for episode 20 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling Wheat Monetization. Little by little.
You think we're simple, you think we're not bright. Look at your cities and ask yourself who's right. We've got country and you've got crime. We've got green and you've got grime. Let there be no doubt, we have what it takes to till the soil until our back aches. Just give us a break and don't be so rude. We love the work and you love the food.
We feed you.